We've been talking the last couple of days about Native American or Indian concerns, and tonight we're going to be doing some talking about racial attitudes. And I've titled this session, Racism Raises Its Ugly Head Again. That's kind of a nasty title, and I hate to even have to talk about that sort of thing, but I guess we ought to try to face up to some realities in our society. So this is one of the things we ought to talk about. How many of you were in the session this afternoon at 4 o'clock with Dave Schroeder? Quite a few of you. Well, this is going to be quite a contrast from that, because that was such a lovely session in which we read poetry and talked about some of the sentimental things that deal with our lives as we get older. And it's quite a switch to move from that to beginning to talk about racial attitudes and racism and so on. By the way, I noticed on the bulletin board that the group that came in today, and there must have been about 15 or 20 that came in, were sponsored by the Green Lake Bible Camp at Spicer, Minnesota. Are any of you in that group? Okay. I don't know, are you from around Spicer? Or? Well, I have to tell you this. I'll tell you the rest. At the Bible camp at Spicer, Minnesota, back in about 1940, they started to build a Norwegian stavkirke. It's one of these, you've seen pictures of those churches with, they were built back in the 11th and 12th century in Norway. They built a replica of that. And Carola and I were married in 1941, right?
Got that right.
1941, right. Boy, I got that right. Good. Anyway, her father was pastor at the Lutheran Church in Spicer. And so we were married out at the Stavkirke out at the Bible camp there, and it wasn't finished at the time. It had a dirt floor, didn't have any pews, and we had nail kegs with planks on for seats. And my wife went into, Carola went into Wilmer, which is not far from there, and borrowed some artificial palm trees from the funeral home so we could decorate the place for our wedding. And I think we were the first, very first wedding to be held in that Green Lake chapel. So,
Rennie, Homer's Rennie, he was there only about 3 years.
Anyway, we've got a very sentimental attachment to that Green Lake Bible Camp that sponsors you people. Okay, there's still a few people getting settled, so we'll wait just a minute before we get started.
Okay.
Fine. Now, I'd like to introduce the subject of racism tonight, and then open it up for dialogue and discussion among us. And please feel free to express yourself if you agree or disagree, or if you've had some experiences you'd like to contribute to the group. Please feel free to express those. I'll take a period of time to introduce the subject. The reason I don't want to take up the whole hour in just lecturing on it is that won't cover the subject by any means, and I think we'll profit a lot more if I can just make a simple, straightforward introduction of the subject and then open it up, because we've all had experiences with interracial relationships, and some of us with racism, and I know we all have strong feelings about it one way or another, or we have questions about it. So I'd like to open it up after a bit. When I decided on that theme, racism raises its ugly head again, I have to explain that, because that doesn't mean that racism hasn't been around for a while. It certainly has. But most of you remember the 1960s when we had a real almost a revolution in our country in regard to race. Black people began to cry out for justice. Hispanic people began to make themselves known. Indian people began to confront society, and we had some real racial confrontations. And I think following that into the 1970s, we sort of leveled off, and a lot of us, particularly us white people, and I guess as I look around, I think most of us in the room are white here tonight, so I can say us white people, most of us white people kind of leaned back and thought, well, yeah, we kind of dealt with that, and the problem is not really very great any longer. So we kind of heaved a little sigh of relief that we weren't being confronted by these blacks and Hispanics and Indians and so on, and probably felt we had a little breather. But in the last few years, it's been very evident that the ugliness of racism has begun to rear its head again in our society. And we've got some very telling evidences of that. I told the group when we were talking about Native American or Indian people that Carol and I live in northern Wisconsin, where there are 9 Indian reservations. And we have some white supremacy groups in northern Wisconsin that are quite strong, several thousands of white people who have joined in white supremacy groups. And they do a lot of ugly things. They have rallies against Indians. They have put out, I told the group the other night, they finance their operations by sponsoring a beer, a can of beer called Treaty Beer. And they sell this beer for about $1.50 a can, and the proceeds go to support their racist kind of activities. We've got a bumper sticker that says, "Shoot an Indian and save a deer," put out by people who think that Indians are harvesting too many deer because the treaties have allowed them to shoot deer out of season. So we have found in our peaceful, rural, northern Wisconsin, those of you who have been in northern Wisconsin know that it's dairy country, a lot of beautiful forests, lovely land, green and nice, and it's really, really just lovely. Here in our lovely part of northern Wisconsin, we've got this ugly manifestation of racism. Now, I'm a Lutheran pastor, and so I'm obviously interested and concerned with our Lutheran church. I'm sad to say that a number of the prominent leaders of these white supremacy groups in Wisconsin are really very active members of the American Lutheran Church, my own church. And I had one of them call me one day because he knew I was involved with Indians. And he called and asked if I wouldn't be interested in joining up with their group. And then he went into a whole sales pitch about how Indians were having more rights than they ought to have, and how Indians were really no good, and all this kind of thing. And when I disagreed with him, he got very abusive to me. And he said, "I can't understand how a Lutheran pastor like you can stand up for those kind of people." And he is a very active, I checked up on him, and I found that he's a very active Lutheran who goes to church almost every Sunday. And he doesn't see any connection, between his religious life and this kind of violent, really, racism. So that's why I said racism is rearing its ugly head again. One of the women who said she was going to be here tonight, I think, is from Chicago. Are you from Chicago?
Yes.
Yeah. Haven't you had a situation down in Chicago going on for quite a while in the political arena?
Right. I think you're referring to the Jewish suburb of Chicago.
Sure.
And they put up a monument to the Holocaust.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. They just had dedicated it the next morning. It was all defaced.
Yes, I read about that, yeah. Well, I'm sure that you, many of you could contribute illustrations to the idea that racism is indeed raising its ugly head among us again. It's been around for a long time, but I think it kind of goes in cycles, and we're seeing it becoming more and more cyclic again and rising up. Now, let's just take a few aspects of racism and take a look at it. It takes many shapes. First of all, I think racism can be just plain dislike of people who are of a different race or a different color. Some people just don't like people who are different. And that's a form of racism. I'd say that that's one of the milder forms of racism. But dislike of other people is one form of racism. Fear of people who are different is a form of racism. And I think that's pretty pervasive. There's a fear of the unknown. Well, when I was a student at the University of Chicago back in 1937, that far back, I was going with a girl, not my present spouse, but this was before I even met her. Very lovely girl. my spouse. Anyway, one evening, she and I decided to go for a walk up the Midway, which is a broad area that goes by the University of Chicago, and about two or three blocks from the campus is a small park, about two, three square blocks. So we decided to walk through this park, and we got about halfway through, and a squad car came running right down the sidewalk of the park and stopped beside us, and the policeman yelled out at me, and he says, "Get that girl out of here. Don't you know there are a lot of niggers in here?" And I was just shocked because I had come from northern Wisconsin and I'd gone to St. Olaf College and I'd never run into anything like this. But there was that fear. I could hear it in his voice that those niggers are out there in that park. So there is often a component of fear in racism. Sometimes the component in racism is a threat, whether it's perceived or real. Sometimes it's a very real threat, but sometimes it's just a perceived threat. For instance, in many areas of the country, white people are afraid of the political power of black people. I think you've had that in Chicago, right, where you've had your Mayor Washington, and then who's the guy of Rodelac that is the...
Verdoliak,
yeah, okay. Who is the city councilman, alderman, who has very strongly opposed the political emergence of black leadership in Chicago. So what you've got there is political fear. Fear on the part of white people that black people in Chicago are going to take over. And if they take over, what will they do to us? You know, economically or physically or what have you. It's a kind of sometimes irrational fear that lies behind racism. Sometimes it's economic. As black people have gained in education, have gained in skills, have gained in rights, we see many of them now becoming executives. Some of them are becoming wealthy. Some of them are becoming national leaders like Jesse Jackson and so on. And as white people see black people emerging in the economic field, they begin to feel threatened by them, and a kind of racism begins to grow up. There is now beginning to be a kind of fear of Hispanics. For many, many years, we didn't think much about importing Mexicans who were not citizens to this country in order to work in the sugar beet fields. I know they come up to North and South Dakota and up into Minnesota and Wisconsin to work in the beet fields. Many of them, of course, work in Texas and in the southern southwest part of the United States. But in recent years, we've begun to realize that there are now maybe 12 million Hispanics that have come into the United States, many of them not citizens, and that they are now beginning to take jobs that some of our white people think really should be the jobs of white people. And so there are moves going on now to try to curb some of this, to try to curb the growing power of economic power of Hispanics. And then there are a lot of people that are very angry at Hispanics because many of those who are not citizens of the United States are still eligible to get certain benefits, certain welfare benefits, certain educational benefits, and the like. And a lot of non-Hispanic people say, that's not right. Those people are not citizens and they ought not to have any of the benefits that are available to Americans like us. It's different with Indian people. Carola and I have been with Indian people in a great many circumstances, and it's different with Indians. Indians are not a threat, mostly, except in one area. There are only about 1,300,000 Indians in the United States, and numerically that's just a drop in the bucket. There are 25 million blacks, 12 or more million Hispanics, but less than 2 million, less than 1.5 million Indians. So the number of Indians does not pose a real threat. But Indians, by treaties, are guaranteed certain rights. Rights for hunting and fishing. You people out here in the... How many of you are from the Seattle area or from this part of the... Yeah, a whole bunch of you. Well, you've heard of the Judge Bolt decision back in the 1970s that allowed Indians to harvest, I guess, about half of the salmon in this area. Carola and I happened to be in the court in Seattle when the Judge Bolt decision was announced. And I can remember that stunned feeling that a great many people had. And then I went to Ballard Church in Seattle. Any of you know where Ballard Church is? Yeah, Ballard is a congregation that has a lot of commercial fishermen, or used to anyway. And I was to speak there the next Sunday. And I was saying some things about Indian rights. And boy, I'll tell you, I almost got my head taken off. Not that the people in Ballard are necessarily racists, but they were threatened. They were really threatened by this new legal decision which gave Indians certain kinds of rights under the treaties. So fear and threat are behind a good deal of racism. And there are a lot of other things, of course. But those are some of the main aspects that are, I believe, components of racism. Now, in order for racism to be a factor, I think there have to be two things present. One is prejudice. Prejudice has all kinds of connotations. It could be stereotyping people. Indians are no good. They're all drunks. They don't like to work. They're never on time, et cetera, et cetera. Blacks are happy-go-lucky, and they like to sing and all that kind of stuff. I mean, prejudice feeds on stereotypes. It feeds on anti-color feelings. It feeds on myths about people who are different. Prejudice feeds on all kinds of things. Some of the things that we are talking about here, political considerations, economic considerations and the like. But prejudice by itself is not all that destructive. I think that many minority groups can deal with prejudice, and some of them can even deal with it, I think, with a fair amount of humor. But it's when you link prejudice with power, that's when racism begins to really bite. And that's when racism begins to really hurt people. Prejudice combined with power. Let me give you an illustration of that from our experience, Kroll and my experience. There's a town, a small city in north central Wisconsin. I won't give it a name, but if some of you are in north central or from north central Wisconsin, you know what it is. It's a medium-sized town, I suppose maybe 3,000-4,000 people. About 10 miles away is a rather large Indian reservation with almost 4,000 Indians. And this community, this town, is the only real town in that area. It has all of the services in the area, so that the Indian people on the reservation must do their business, their shopping, and all the rest of it in that town. Now, this is what I mean by the combination of prejudice and power. In that community, there's a lot of prejudice against Indians. I know that. The reason I know that is that back in the late 1960s, the American Lutheran Church set aside a sum of $500,000 to be distributed among minority groups because the ALC, together with a lot of other churches, felt that they too had been discriminating against minority peoples. And minority groups were allowed to make application for grants. And in this Indian reservation near this community asked for a grant of $5,000 to buy some cranberry picking machinery. In northern Wisconsin, we have a lot of cranberry bogs. And the Indians had some cranberry bogs, and they wanted to get some cranberry picking machinery. Well, the church thought that's a great idea. And a grant of $5,000 was made. But we had a practice that we didn't send it from Minneapolis to the group. We gave it through a local entity of the American Lutheran Church, a congregation or an agency or something like that. So we wrote a letter to our ALC congregation in that town and said, we have this $5,000 that we're going to give to the Indian people on the reservation. Immediately, a letter came back saying, nothing doing. We want nothing to do with it. Wow, what to do? So the committee in Minneapolis asked me to go up and meet with the church council. And I went up and I met with the church council. And I haven't had such a bad meeting in years. These people just spouted out their anger at Indians. They didn't like Indians. They didn't want anything to do with them. They said if they gave this $5,000 to them, pretty soon some of them would be coming over to the church. They wanted more. If we gave them some money, they'd want more money, and they didn't want anything to do with it. So there we were, and we couldn't give away this $5,000 because we had this policy that we gave it to a local entity. Well, fortunately, a few months later, the pastor called me, and he said, I persuaded the chairman of the church council to go with me and take this check off to the Indian reservation on the condition that you don't do any publicity about it at all, so that nobody will know about it. So that's kind of tells you something about this aspect there. But now let's look at this aspect. Just that attitude wasn't really hurting the Indians too badly, because, you know, the Indians weren't too upset that these Lutherans over here didn't care about them, you know, after all. didn't bother them that much. But when you look at who holds the power in that area, the police are in the community are all white. The sheriff's office is all white. All of the lawyers in town, I think there are about six, are white. The grocery store owners are white. The bankers are white. The teachers in the school system are white. The welfare workers in the welfare office in the county are white. That's the forestry country up there. The foresters are white. The DNR people, the Department of Natural Resources, the game wardens and so on, are all white. So here is what you have. You have an Indian reservation with 4,000 Indians who have to do business in that community. There's no other place for them to go. There are towns maybe 30, 40 miles away, but you know, Indians are rather poor and they don't have transportation to go to those towns. So they have to deal for everything, no matter what it is, groceries, welfare, legal things, police protection, schools, everything, with a predominant white community that holds every position of power. And so that town is able to hold that whole Indian reservation, those whole 4,000 Indian people, in its own grasp and dictate the terms under which those Indian people live. Now that's an illustration. I'm not pointing this town out as an awful example. This is true almost universally. Wherever there is prejudice and you combine it with power, that gives to the predominant group, whether it's white or whoever else, the power to dictate what happens to the lives of people. I suppose the best illustration of that of all is not in our own country, but it's in South Africa, where a group of, what is it, 3 to 4 million white people, because they live in a prejudiced society and hold the power, economic and military and all the rest of it, can subjugate 17 or 18 million black people and dictate the terms under which they live. Now that is what racism really is, I think, is prejudice combined with power. When you can take racial attitudes and then enforce them, then you have what I would call racism. Okay, just a couple more things, then I'm going to open it up for discussion. Just a comment about something that may be a little more subtle than this. take our church. I presume most of you are Lutherans here, but perhaps not. But I would say that for most of the mainline churches, whether it's Presbyterians or Episcopalians or Lutherans or Methodists or what have you, it's somewhat similar. But the Lutheran churches in this country are about 97% white. Many people of color do not join our Lutheran churches. It's not that we haven't reached out to them. We have. But many people of color do not join our Lutheran churches because they're fearful, first of all, of this monolithic whiteness of our church. And secondly, they are fearful that if they do become members of our churches, they will be so submerged by the power structures of the church councils, the church machinery, and all the rest of it, that they will never have a chance to have their voice heard. I've talked to quite a few non-white people about their attitude toward the church. It isn't that they don't like Lutheran doctrine, It isn't that they don't like the kinds of things we do. It's their fear that even in the church, power will be exercised to keep them at a level where they won't bother us, 97% of the white people. One more example of that, and then I'll open it up for discussion. Carola and I were, some years ago, asked by St. Olaf College, which is my college. Carola's mother went to St. Olaf. My mother and father went to St. Olaf. Our son went to St. Olaf, and we now have a granddaughter who's going to be a senior in high school this year, and she has already gone down there to register at St. Olaf. So we'll have four generations there. I love that school. I really do. But they had 17 Indian students at St. Olaf back about 6-8 years ago. And then the next year they had about 14, and then the next year it went down to 10. And they were a little upset. So they appointed or asked a committee of Indian people. And then they asked Carol and me to sit in on that, to form a committee to look into why St. Olaf was losing its Indian students. Well, we met for about 6 or 8 months, we must have met 5 or 6 times. And we really studied the situation and came up with some pretty strong conclusions about why Indian people were not staying at St. Olaf. And so we made a series of recommendations to the college. And the college thanked us very much and gave us a dinner and dismissed us and said, yes, we'll receive your recommendations and so on. 6 months went by, nothing had happened. And the Indian people on the committee were pretty upset. And they said, well, what's going on here? And the chairman, who was an Indian, asked the college if they couldn't meet again. And then we met with the president and the dean of the faculty. And they kind of hummed and hawed around, and then they began to deal with the things that we had suggested. We had suggested, for example, that they hadn't had any center where Indian students could gather to share with one another and to just have fellowship among each other. They didn't have anybody on the faculty who could be their advisor, who really understood Indians. So we had recommended that they get someone, preferably an Indian. Indian people often don't have good preparation through high school. Many of them are dropouts and so on. So academically, they are not as accelerated as a lot of white people are. So we recommended that they set up some tutoring programs for Indians so that they could catch up with some of the other white students. And a couple of other recommendations. Well, the president and the dean said, finally, just flat out, we have come to the conclusion that probably St. Olaf isn't for most Indian students. We don't have funding to set up a special center for Indians. If we did that, we'd have to do it for Swedes and Norwegians and Germans and all the rest of them. Which, of course, is baloney, you know, because the whole college is a center for those kind of people. I mean, our kind of people. And they didn't want to engage a special tutor because academically, St. Olaf takes students from the top 15 or 20% of high school graduating classes, and they felt that if Indian students had to have a special tutor, they'd feel uncomfortable about that. So they didn't feel that was good. Thirdly, St. Olaf is a high cost school. Next year, my granddaughter, when she goes, her tuition will be $10,700. And they said, most Indians can't afford that. So they came to the conclusion that, well, I guess St. Olaf is just not for Indians. Well, that made me real sad, because I realized that those Indians didn't really need St. Olaf. They can go to other places. But St. Olaf needs those Indians. We in the church need those Indians. St. Olaf is a monolithic white community. You know, white middle, upper middle class. And those kids go through 4 years of college with hardly rubbing shoulders with anybody who's different. And they need those Indians. But that, I'm sorry to say, reflects, I think, the kind of subtle prejudice that has all kinds of good reasons, kind of a subtle racism that pervades even the church and its institutions, results in a racism that many of us never even recognize that we're participating in. So racism, in a sense, even pervades the church. Even Holden. We're a white community here, by and large. And certainly none of us would say that we're prejudiced against blacks or Indians or anybody else. And yet somehow, when we come together, we're a monolithic, single-race people, even in a place like Holden that stresses community. So you can see how subtle racism can really be. Well, it's a lot more that could be said. But let's just open it up now for some dialogue and some discussion and some questions and so on. Yeah?
Well, the Lutheran seminary that I just attended the last 3 years, I was on the cross-cultural committee, and they do have one Indian on the faculty, and we worked very, very hard trying to get cross-cultural curriculum and sensitizing seminary students so they can go out and be a little aware. And the faculty just was at loggerheads. It got a very hot debate, even just getting this in the curriculum for seminary students. And the proposal was denied. The fellow who's the Indian there is having a terrible time in relations with the rest of the faculty, seen as a rebel, and and these pastors are going to be going out and serving around the areas, and it was real disheartening for a lot of us.
Did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I was wondering if maybe one of the most common forms of racism that we know might be what I call theological racism, where those of us in the Missouri Synod feel superior to the ALC. don't take me seriously on that, please. But, I mean, we are. That's one of the most common prejudices that I'm exposed to.
I did mention this the other day in connection with Indians, but 2 weeks ago I was in Denver for 4 days for a conference of pastors who are serving, white pastors who are serving in Indian congregations, Lutheran Indian congregations. There are a few of them. And we had an Indian leader, and he was talking about theology. And he said that the trouble with you Lutherans is, you white Lutherans, is that you come at us Indians with theology all thought out from your own Northern European point of view. And he said, you never take into account our spiritual heritage as you are dealing with Christian theology. And he said, for example, he said, we Indians always start with creation when we're talking with God. You people start with sin and grace. And he said, we don't understand that. We always think of the Creator first. And he said, you don't even follow your creed, which starts with creation and then goes to Christ and then to the Holy Spirit. And that really took the group back quite a bit, you know, because they'd never thought about what you're saying, that even in theology we sometimes are so narrowly focused that we can't look at another person's point of view.
Yesterday you started off by saying Native American and then you said Indian, and you would prefer to use the term Indian. Why is that?
Only because Indians themselves do that.
I mean, I'm glad to know that, because I've been doing a little volunteer work in South Minneapolis and thinking I must say Native American.
No.
I'm not going
to
volunteer.
I've never heard Indians refer to themselves as Native Americans.
That's never.
They always refer to themselves as Indians. So feel comfortable. Yeah, did I see another hand?
I'd like to hear you discuss a little bit what we're going to do about this. I think we all understand somewhat the prejudice, and we've all lived one way or another with it. But now, where do we go from understanding the problem?
Okay, I've got a few ideas, but the fact is I'm a little embarrassed to say them because most of them have been tried and haven't worked too well. So before I try to answer that question, let me hear if any of you have some ideas about what we can do about this situation, if you feel something needs to be done about it, or should be done about it. Anybody got any thoughts about how we can deal with all of that?
Well, I don't have an idea of this, but another area of prejudice in our church, Missouri Synod, is the Spanish. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get the Spanish mission started and get, some of them are very prejudiced. Mm-hmm. Why can't they if they come to our country, why can't they take our culture and our language?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's a common attitude. Very common. If they want to join us, let them become like us.
One of the things that I feel like maybe I would try to do is to, because part of my prejudice or feelings that I can see exist maybe in the community where I live would be the fears and not really knowing or understanding, or like when you were describing, you know, the way that they look at theology starting from a different standpoint. Well, that was a new thought to me. But maybe I would know better how to relate to and be comfortable around if I knew a little bit more of them. Because they're such, for Indians in particular, such a small group, there's not a whole lot of museums, workshops, so forth, you know, that they have to offer for us. Would some people, you know, myself or different people who are interested in working with Indians, if somehow they could help the Indians facilitate teaching the white people about their culture so that part of the fear is dissolved in just knowing what they're about. And what.
All right, that's a very good suggestion, and that's one of the things that I would have said. And Carol and I have worked on this a great deal. The Northern Wisconsin District of the ALC, to which we belong, back in about 1976 or 77, began a program called New Beginnings, because we've got 9 Indian reservations there, and many, many of our congregations are very close to Indians. I mean, physically close. And one of the things that this New Beginnings program stressed was that very thing that you're talking about, letting Indian people teach us something. And what we did there was the Northern Wisconsin District set aside some money, so we had a little money to deal with. Not a lot, but several thousand dollars. What we did there was to set up a meeting, a 3-day meeting with Indian people on the reservation. And we asked for volunteers, people who were interested from our congregation. And we usually got about 25 or 30 white people who would be willing to spend 3 days on an Indian reservation as guests of Indians, listening to Indians tell about themselves, their life, the problems they face, their spirituality, and the like. And we had some just tremendous things happen there, white people, who lived in the midst of Indian people, who felt that earlier they felt, oh, we know Indians, we see them on the street and so on, but they got a whole new picture of what it's like to be Indian. And many, many, many friendships were cemented at those meetings. And I think Indian people came to have a new perception of the Lutheran Church and its witness, you know, to Christ. So that's really one thing that can be done. It takes a little money, because for one thing, we paid the Indian leaders you know, instead of saying, we'd like to have you teach us about Indians, you know, we're doing you a favor by coming and listening to you. We paid them, and what that said to them, a couple of them told me this, was, you must value what we have to say.
I would say that would be very valid.
So we paid those Indian people, and then we paid our food and lodging and things like that.
Well, we had, if, you know, somebody wanted to put on a program and they wanted a speaker to come to the program, they wouldn't expect the guy to volunteer. I mean, they would, you know.
Oh, a lot of people will invite an Indian or a black person to come and speak and then feel that they've done him a favor to do so and never think of paying him anything. You know, after all, we're willing to listen to you. Okay, that's one good idea. The possibility of setting up dialogue between color, people of color, and people of the church or groups of white people. Yeah.
I wish that there was some way in our teaching and preaching and being together in our churches that we could divest ourselves of our cultural arrogance and somehow remove that Northern European cultural trappings and separate that out from the essence of our religion, which allows us to be proud of being Scandinavian or whatever we are, but that says this is not Christianity. Christianity is not the work ethic. Christianity is not our ethnic trappings that we put on it, because I think that makes people of other races so uncomfortable, because if you're Indian, you're not Scandinavian, you know, and if you're black, you're not Scandinavian, and somehow, if we could be, if I could be less confused about where that line lies, there would be much more room in my Christian faith for others to enter who are Indian Christian, black
okay.
Christian.
What you're saying is that there's an overbalance of cultural...
I'm saying we get confused.
...overload in our religious...
we get confused.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think that's a natural human situation, and I don't think any of us can ever get away from our cultural heritage. It's pretty difficult to do. Even Indian people.
I would think at the same time as we carry out the first suggestion that we could begin to sort of open ourselves to the idea that there's room for other cultures within our religious expression without being threatened.
Okay, you're talking about trying to get rid of cultural dominance in our relationships and in our religion. Okay, that's not an easy thing to do, but it's a good idea. Yeah.
Well, I have a story that relates to that. I was working with a group of children a few weeks ago, and in this group of children we had three or four children from our Vietnamese family that we've adopted. One of the Scandinavian children in the group said to one of the girls, I'm not going to sit by you, I'm going to sit by a Chinese girl. And I thought, well, all right, I can see where that's coming from. I wasn't too shocked. But then, the same child said to another member of that family, you're really weird. I don't like you. You have too many brothers and sisters. And you know where that's coming from? That's coming right out of the mouths of that kid's parents.
Sure, sure.
And so, you know, we're missing the boat there when in our homes.
Yeah, right.
We're telling our kids, you know, that family who've adopted the church, they wouldn't be in the boat they're in if they wouldn't keep having kids.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that a lot of prejudice, you mentioned prejudice before, a lot of prejudice comes through parental influence, attitudes. I've heard many Indian people say that when their kids play with white kids, there's no real problem until they begin to get up to 7, 8, 9 years old, and then all of a sudden the white kids begin to reflect the attitudes of their parents. And they began to hear that Indians are drunks and the Indians are lazy and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it really does come from the church. So parental influence needs to be dealt with.
I do know.
I think this fellow had his hand up before.
Stressing or emphasizing the attitudes of the young, I think, is a place to start. And I've seen fairly effective use of that
okay.
In some schools. we would bring in as a role model of Native Indians, somebody that they had some background. You know, we had in our area a very famous guy by the name of Chief Dan George.
Okay.
And any time that we could bring him into a school, he packed the place voluntarily. And he related, and you can see the effects of it.
Okay, role models. And, you know, that's not easy to find, I think. No. But I think if we dig hard enough, we can do so. Blacks, Hispanics, Indians, whoever you're near, that can be done. Okay, did I see another hand?
I think it's just as important to get to know these people. I work with black nurses in Shelbyville, Indiana, and I don't see their color anymore.
Okay, sure. Good. The opportunities to work together are not so big. We have to create some. Yeah.
There's a couple things that I've valued a lot besides my Indian friend taking me to a reservation or sweat lodges, but she's given me a wonderful reading list of ballad, history, and traditional books to read so I can immerse myself into their history.
Okay.
And reading has just informed me so much of their tradition and history. And otherwise, I wouldn't have known what to read.
Okay.
As I understand, the best way to get up the economic ladder is education. How does our Western concept of time and work, and you mentioned the Indians' concept of time and work previous, how does the Indians' concept of time and work interfere with their ability to get a Western education?
Quite a bit.
And how do so obviously K-8 is where you, or I mean,
There's a lot of cultural overlay here, and talking about racism, I'm not really only talking about Indians, but different races deal differently, or different cultures deal differently. Take the Vietnamese that are coming to this country now. Boy, their concepts of time and work fit right in with ours, and some of them are forging ahead so that many schools, the top students are now Vietnamese. And that embarrasses a lot of us white people to think of. And you remember on TV a year or so ago, this young woman that was graduated the tops at, was it the Air Force Academy or the one of the military academies? A lot of white people really got shook up about that. And black people for a long time had a difficult time in school, but many of them are now beginning to overcome that. Indian people are still having a very difficult time with their cultural heritage in relationship to time and work and study and all of that. That has yet to come, and I don't know the answer to that problem.
Do they lose part of their Indian heritage?
Yes.
When they get this education?
One of the great problems with Indian people is that when a young Indian goes away to school and maybe does well, goes on to college, spends 4 years in college, maybe goes on to law school or medical school or something, comes back, is not accepted. He's gone white. See? Or has lost his empathy with his Indian ancestry or so on. And many Indians can't go back because of cultural blocks. That's a tough problem. I don't know the answer. Yeah.
Some time ago, we listened to an Indian speaking to whites, Indians, and he indicated that the Indian group lacks leadership in their numbers, and that in the whole United States, he said that there are only 17 Indians with their doctor's degree.
Yeah. Okay. If I could give my point of view on what you're saying, when somebody says Indians lack leadership, they mean they're lacking leadership in our perception of what leadership is. There is a great deal of leadership in the Indian community, but it's not the same kind of leadership that we have. It is not the kind of leadership that comes from position or education or money or that kind of thing. It's the kind of leadership that comes up out of the people that relates sometimes to the older people in the tribe. And the leader in Indian communities is often the servant of the rest of the people rather than the leader of the rest of the people. And that's a cultural thing again, you see. So when you talk about leadership, you got to be careful you aren't talking about our idea of leadership instead of their idea of leadership. Well, it's quarter after, and we have Vespers at 7:30, so you ought to have a few minutes to relax. And all we've done tonight is just open this subject up. It's such a complex, difficult subject that to try to deal with it in a session is just, you know, really only to crack the nut a little bit and get it open so we can take a look at it. But all of us, if we have a sense of compassion for our fellow human beings, and if we have a sense of the inclusiveness of the Christian gospel, that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow, and maybe we'll deal with this a little bit. No, not tomorrow, Friday. So around on Friday, the New Lutheran Church has said that it's going to be inclusive. Include everybody. I'd like to address that on Friday, and we'll talk about what that means. And we'll get into some of this stuff, like leadership.
I can hear that.
Okay, thank you very much.